so stupid, he comes across in front of me every single time he overtakes. Where does he want me to go off the track?
A Bender brother wins in a MotoGP weekend, and Jamie Chadwick is your W Series champion. Must be King's birthday. Welcome back to Motorsport 101. Birthday, King!
Ooh, thank you, thank you. Man, this weekend has been peak my birthday weekend.
KTM are in the headlines, and your girl made history as the first W Series champion. How does it feel?
I just want your hand back.
I promise we won't tease you too much. Yes, I
promise nothing.
On behalf of your friendly neighborhood host, Andre Harrison, we are RJ O'Connell, Ryan Eric King, and Cam Buckley. We are Motorsport 101. Welcome to episode 207 of this fine podcast, where among the many things we'll talk about, the MotoGP Austrian Grand Prix and a last lap thriller as Andrea Dovizioso passes Mark Marquez on the very last corner to maintain Fortress Ducati's unbeaten record at the Red Bull Ring, which we'll also talk about Brad Binder's win, and hey, some other guy won a Moto 3, some guy named Fanati. I guess he's okay, I guess, sure. We'll talk about the brand finale, W Series and DTM at Brands Hatch, Alice Powell taking the final victory of the Simi, and Jamie Chadwick winning the title over Bietzka Visser in what was a pretty awesome race. But we want to get into the news here first, because a lot
Holy
happened.
Holy shit!
Yeah. So, for reference, developments on the day of recording mean that McLaren and Schmidt-Peterson Motorsports entering a merger for 2020 is now the second biggest news story in our set list.
Man. Man, who did we, like, offend? Because I swear, I didn't say one word. Not one word. Like,
who haven't we offended?
Please, please. Actually, I'm not going to tell everybody to at Lewis Sotheby 23 this time. Places you can find us. We're on YouTube.com/Motorsport101. Facebook.com/Motorsport101. We're on Twitter at Motorsport_101. If you wish to follow us personally, you can. At Harrison101HD. At Ryan Eric King. That's with two Ks. At RJ O'Connell. That's with two N's and two L's. And at CBuckley917. That's with no vowels. Everything you can find related to our podcast, written works, is at Motorsport101.com. And you can back us financially at patreon.com/motorsport101 for just $5 a month. You can get access, early access to all of our shows, and for $10 a month, we will let you into the supporters club of our Discord section, provided, of course, that you meet the minimum dress code requirements. We have those, right?
We have topics of conversation that'll immediately get you kicked from the VC.
These wouldn't happen to involve personalities in events that we will be talking about, right?
We'll leave that for them to find out if
no
they
one
decide.
Say anything bad about King's girlfriend.
Whoa!
Tony, whoa. Vincent, Jason, Josette, Henry, and Brian are all listening to the show. Before we all kill each other, let's get into the news. Oh my god, Red Bull, you actually fucking did it. You mad sons of bitches.
We had the Hungarian Grand Prix. In it, a race where Pierre Gasly was lapped in by his teammate and runner-up Max Verstappen, Christian Horner maintained that Pierre was probably going to stay in the car for the rest of the season. 8 days later, it turns out his word is about as reliable as his 2018 car was. So for the second time in 3 years, Red Bull demotes one of their own, as Gasly goes back to Toro Rosso with Alex Albon heading the other way. It's a move that many had speculated and teased, but to actually see it happen is no less shocking. For Pierre Gasly, it's been the cherry on top of what's been a miserable sophomore year in F1. Make no mistake, he's been a massive disappointment and his demotion is somewhat understandable. He's probably the main reason Red Bull can't make a run at Ferrari for second in the championship. But that's the risk you run when you promote a rookie to a top tier seat, and maybe a little bit too quickly too. Let's not forget, his teammate is Max Verstappen, a man who's been arguably the best driver in F1 pound for pound for the last year. When that's your yardstick, you've been shown the door after just 12 races, it makes you wonder what he could have done. A borderline unwinnable situation for someone we saw, and should still see, as an exceptional talent. And that's not the only element of this swap that's saddening. This should be a wonderful story for Alex Albon. 18 months ago, his career looked like a dead end in Formula 2. Talented, but lacking funding and question marks remained over his long-term future. He was virtually nailed on to drive for Nissan's Formula E team. Now, he's getting a golden chance to race half a season with a team that has the potential to win Grand Prix. But now, he's under extreme pressure to succeed immediately. Red Bull more or less said in its press release that this was going to be a guinea pig run for the permanent second Red Bull seat for 2020. Albon's future isn't any more secure here, and if we're being critical, he's not exactly set the world alight either. 6-6 in qualifying battles against his teammate, and a 3-6 record in races they've both finished. If Gasly was risky at the start of the year, replacing him for a guy who only has 12 career starts is even riskier, and I personally am struggling to see the benefits. I also worry, given this team's horrible reputation, that he could just be another guy chewed up and spat out by the system. And not to mention, by any measure, Daniil Kvyat's return to F1 has been excellent. The German podium a reminder of his class, the first for Toro Rosso in 11 years. Proof that getting your head back in line and grinding out results can pay off. But let's not remind ourselves of how we got to this point. A near carbon copy culling 3 years ago that undeservedly damaged a chunk of the man's career. And he got overlooked again here for Albon, when Kvyat was clearly the safer bet. I get he's not the sexy pick due to him being a known quantity, but how many times can you gloss over a guy with clear ability? Personally, I think Dr. Marco would rather stick his nuts in a food blender than admit he got it wrong on Daniil, but who knows what goes on in their business meetings these days. This is the risk that Red Bull is taking. In their desperation to fight for the silver medal, they risk alienating their entire fleet of current drivers because none of them is as good as Max Verstappen, the man they already sacrificed everything for to get to this point. Max kicked up a stink and threatened to leave just after Kvyat had that hometown crash 3 years ago. He vetoed a promotion for Carlos Sainz last year, Carlos himself now probably laughing as the academy he left implodes on itself yet again. It may even be a factor as to why Lando Norris is now there too, given Toro Rosso was a contender for his services when he was still in Formula 2, actively shopping their staff as part of the deal. By any measure, this is a mess for a Red Bull camp whose academy is sometimes a bit too good. I've made countless episodes on this channel of this show on their relentlessly brutal treatment of drivers that aren't S-tier prospects. And I've barely even glossed over Daniel Ricciardo's departure from last year, the third most successful driver they've ever had, and the biggest rising star of the hybrid era to date. Those who fail to heed history are doomed to repeat it. Once again, Red Bull's put themselves in a pickle that they didn't need to be in, and may cause yet more damage to young drivers' careers they claim to believe in. One can only hope said talent finds a way to shine like it so often does. Sadly, this only seems to happen outside of Red Bull's own system. I don't want Pierre to be another statistic, another notch on Red Bull's bedpost of drivers who've made a mockery of their academy by succeeding outside their umbrella. He's in a rough patch, and as a Sebastian Vettel fan, I can certainly relate. I just hope his new teammate reminds him that you can come out of the other side. And for the sport's sake, I hope Red Bull's ruthlessness ends before more careers are damaged beyond repair.
It's the story that's jumped the day. Pierre Gasly is moving back to Toro Rosso. Alex Albon, the rookie, is moving up to Red Bull Racing. Sweet Jesus!
Kvyat's just looking over like, first time, huh?
First time.
I thought we lived in a world where we didn't have to deal with mid-season F1 driver changes anymore.
It wasn't but a little over a week ago that Red Bull team principal Christian Horner gave Pierre Gasly the old vote of confidence. You know, the thing that people give Premier League managers when you know they're about to get fired? Saying that Gasly was going to see out the 2020 season. And now, just 8 days later, he has been demoted back to Toro Rosso. Now, Xander Albon, the third-place man in the Formula 2 series, who, again, 18 months ago was very close to quitting with no funding and no immediate future, he's now going to one of the prime seats on the F1 grid alongside Max Verstappen. Oof.
Talk about a baptism of fire. Holy shit.
I know Pierre has struggled. I've said my piece that, you know, I think he's a much better driver than his results indicate. But I would have had no problem if Red Bull had just said, okay, at the midpoint in the season, about Canada or France, it's just like he has to start performing or he will be demoted by the time we get to the midway point of the season. I would have had no problem with that. Yes, it would have seemed cruel, but it wouldn't seem like you were leading him on to believe that he was safe to go for the rest of the season, and then, boom, you flip the switch on this. That's what I have a main problem with.
I have to agree. Just be straight up with it. You know, F1 is already full of enough bullshit as it is.
Right. We're not going to bullshit you, and we're not going to bullshit you and tell you that Pierre Gasly's performance was not costing Red Bull a genuine shot at second of the World Constructors' Championship. It was.
Yeah. I mean, with the utter collapse of Ferrari's pace, coupled to Verstappen just killing it in that car.
Right.
It's simple math. You know, you look at the standings, Gasly's points total is costing them second in the World Constructors, and by a margin as well.
Right, he's not even averaging in the top six, which would be the absolute bare minimum that what you would expect for driving for one of the top three teams who have a clear gulf between themselves and everybody else in the field and have had for a number of years. That's my first point I want to make. The second,
yeah.
Daniel Kvyat just gave Toro Rosso a podium finish in his first year back. And by not giving them this opportunity, you've kind of given credence to the people who cynically believed, when he was first brought back, that Danny Kvyat was just a stopgap option until they can find somebody else. Because keep in mind, it was at that point when they signed him for 2019 that Red Bull were trying to move the earth, the mountains, and the heavens above to try and get Dan Ticktum 40 super license points. Now he's gone, and the next people up are Yuri Vips, who's killing it in Formula 3, and Pato O'Ward, who's doing a complete career 180.
Yeah, and as it stands, they simply don't have the license points to enter Formula 1. They're at least a year away, maybe more. Red Bull's hands are tied on this one.
They did say that they're using the next 9 races to evaluate who will drive alongside Max in 2020. So by that definition, Daniel is not completely out of it. But I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, he gets passed over again and he's forced to look elsewhere for opportunities to advance up the grid.
But on that note, looking forward to 2020, Red Bull can't sweep the decks at Toro Rosso. That's not realistic.
No.
They don't have enough personnel to fill those gaps.
Right.
I mean, right now, they're in a situation where if Albon doesn't work out and he's as far off the pace Max as Gasly was, they have Max, and then their only 3 drivers who they can realistically have in the seats are all damaged goods.
Right. Because this demotion, I don't know how Pierre will react. I would assume that being under less pressure would help him, and the Toro Rosso is not a bad car. It's not as capable as Red Bull, but it's not like he's going back to Williams, or heaven forbid being left off the grid at all. I don't know which one would be worse for him.
Williams.
Right. And that gets me to my next point about Alexander Albon. He's a great guy. He's worked very hard to get to this point. Again, 18 months ago, he wasn't sure if he would continue racing. He was on a race-to-race deal in Formula 2. Then suddenly, he became a title contender. Got a Formula E drive. Backed out of that for one last shot at Formula 1, which has now turned from a Toro Rosso drive to a Red Bull drive. He is a very likable young guy and a very talented racing driver. But my fear is that he is being put in a position where he cannot succeed. Alongside Max Verstappen in his prime, in a team that is built and designed around Max Verstappen, for Max Verstappen, almost by Max Verstappen. That's my worry.
Yeah. The deck is kind of stacked against him in that regard. And as you said earlier, we know that Gasly has achieved enough that we know he's better than what he's shown in the Red Bull.
Again, but to list his credentials, the only person that beat him in 2014 in the Formula Renault 3.5 series was arguably the man Red Bull should have had in the first place, Carlos Sainz Jr. He was 2016 GP2 series champion. He was 2014 Super Formula runner-up. Pierre can drive. He was not getting the most out of that car, but the man can drive.
Yeah, and for me, the really big worry is, as I said, if Albon's just as far off the pace, I mean, are they going to put Kvyat in next when we know that he and Max would have a horrible relationship because of what happened in 2016?
Also, this is going to sound very wild and very out there, but there is not, he's not a Red Bull driver, but he's tangentially related to Red Bull, has enough super license points. I don't know if you'd be willing to go to F1, but Naoki Yamamoto has enough super license points to go to F1.
I would love that, and so, I know, Cam, you and I have discussed this.
Yes.
That would be awesome, but the thing that I worry about is they wouldn't take a risk on a guy who's going to turn 32 next year, who's come out of the same series where people will say, well, Stoffel Vandoorne and Pierre Gasly came out of there, and they were both bust. Why would you take a chance on UGE Day 2? And I know he's much better than that.
Yeah, but I mean, the problem with Yamamoto is for as brilliant as he is, and he's a fucking brilliant racing driver, Japan double champion, he's 32 years old. That's not a long-term plan.
Exactly. That's why it would work for Red Bull. They don't have to keep him long-term. They just have to wait till the next Red Bull Junior is ready.
But how long might that be? What happens if they're not if Pato O'Ward gets another opportunity elsewhere? And we'll talk about this next. What happens if Yuri Vips doesn't turn out to be Estonia's next great hope? Who knows? All I know is I'm hoping that Alex Albon can show signs of improvement for a team that needs it. I hope that Pierre Gasly can bounce back. I hope that Daniel Kvyat can find opportunities, whether it be within the Red Bull family or outside of it, to succeed. Because, to me, it's all a mess. This whole situation gives more firepower to all of Red Bull's detractors. For very good reasons.
Yeah, I mean, they've made this bed by burning their whole driver academy. First on Max, and then, you know, after Max. As you said, they moved everything trying to get Tictum in that seat, and then Tictum shot all over Honda and didn't have two world championships to back him up on it.
Right. Yeah, that's the other thing, is that where this all stems from, letting Verstappen and Sainz's professional relationship at Toro Rosso get to the point where the two of them just could not work together. Because if they could work together professionally, if things hadn't deteriorated over 2015 and 16, that would be an incredible lineup. But they can't have that now. Not for another few years.
No, that bridge is gone.
And it's not like they could sign some amazing junior driver into their academy, because the junior ladder right now is pretty barren, to be honest.
Yeah, and it's another symptom of what's going on in F1, where you've got all the different young driver programs, and they just go straight up. If they get up into F1, they just go up into the B team or primary team of who they're contracted to.
Yeah, and the thing is, everyone who would populate like the junior series at the moment, who would be in their late teens or early 20s, like a spectacular F2 driver, they're in F1 right now. They're all in F1 right now.
They're all either in F1 or they're already contracted to another team.
Right. Before we poo-poo on this 2019 class in Formula 2, let's just forget we got real lucky in 2018 to have the top three in the championship come up all at once.
Yeah, all at once.
Sit through me through the years of 2012, 13, and 14, and then come back to me about how bad 2019 is. It ain't even that bad.
Hi, Davide Valsecchi. Sorry.
Sorry,
Fabio Limer, where are you at?
Where is Fabio Limer at? That's what I really want
to know. I think he's in Blancpain now.
I don't even think he's there. Well, Davide found a much better gig, and that is, of course, as the subject of the latest distracted girlfriend meme.
Oh, no.
Well, and also for being the most enthusiastic man to ever commentate anything.
Davide has the same problem that Jim Ross has. Whenever you hear Jim Ross on commentary in WWE video games, he sounds like he's running at about a quarter energy, and it's the same with Davide when you listen to him in F1 2019.
Yeah.
All of this, and now this story has now been demoted to second place on our news list. McLaren is back in IndyCar. McLaren is back in IndyCar, and they're joining forces with Schmidt-Peterson Motorsports and Chevrolet full-time for 2020.
Aero McLaren Racing SP.
Oh, my
God. Oh, man. I do feel uncomfortable calling it a partnership, though. But we'll run down the details first before we get into the nitty-gritty of what is actually happening.
Yes, this just broke on Friday that McLaren Racing will return to full-time competition in the NTT IndyCar Series through a strategic partnership with Aero Schmidt-Peterson Motorsports and Chevrolet. Key being important here because, again, McLaren and Honda, they don't have the best relationship right now, shall we say. So, Chevrolet it is.
If I recall the quote that was tossed around when McLaren called Honda for an engine this year for Indy, go find your engine somewhere else. Well, they did.
Under the partnership, the team will be renamed Aero McLaren Racing SP and will field two Chevrolet Power Cars next season, reflecting the continuing status of Aero Electronics as the team's title partner, as well as a new manufacturer partnership with Chevrolet. Jill DeFerrin will lead the McLaren IndyCar program and involvement in Aero McLaren Racing SP. He will lead a dedicated group from McLaren Racing independent of the Formula One team. Co-founders Sam Schmidt and Rick Peterson continue in their current roles as co-owners of the team. Hopefully, Zach Brown will not be having to dig around for steering wheels.
Just paint the goddamn car the right color of orange! Please!
So, James Hinchcliffe has weighed in. His future with the team seems to be sure, but man, that's a big blow because he was Honda Canada, especially. He was their lead man.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like Honda doesn't have a whole team of drivers they can just go edit into those commercials, but that is a huge representative of Honda over in North America. Mm-hmm. Now fighting for the enemy.
Yeah. And we know that Marcus Ericsson, as funny as he's been to watch an IndyCar, might be underperforming the potential of his equipment, even though he can build a race car in 5 minutes. We've seen those SPM skits. But if not Ericsson, who do they get next?
Well, the rumors that have been tossed around have pointed to potentially Felipe Nasr, currently driving for Action Express Racing in IMSA.
Essentially, I've seen so many articles written about this. So the one that you referenced is mainly the one written for the Monolith by David Mulcher, where he throws out two possible contenders, one being Felipe Nasr and the other being Nicholas Latifi.
Spicy.
Yes, Formula 2, second in standings.
Robin Miller also put out a column. His list is a lot more extensive, to say the least.
Well, of course it is.
You gotta cover all the bases. That way, if you're wrong, you're only wrong by a little bit.
So, running down his list, the contenders include Colton Herta, obviously James Hinchcliffe, Marcus Ericsson, Connor Daly, Santino Ferrucci, Pato O'Ward, Spencer Pigot, Ed Jones, Tony Kanaan, Matthias Leist, Oliver Askew, Rinus VK, Felipe Nasr, Nicholas Latifi, and
every free agent.
And his final dream pick is Fernando Alonso, where, quote, we all want to see Fred back at Indy in a competitive car, but watching him at Road America or Long Beach or Iowa would be an added pleasure. Who knows? He might want to run a half dozen IndyCar races, and I'll buy his sloppy joes in Iowa, end quote.
Yeah, apparently there will also be a third car in the mix. Not full-time, maybe just for Indy. So where does this leave Fernando Alonso, who, despite earlier speculations and reports from Motorsport Magazine, the other sport magazine, McLaren and Fernando Alonso, still tight. Alonso's apparently going to do Dakar, not doing the WEC, so he's got a lot of time left after January and February.
Oh, he already picked the WEC clean.
But he's already stated he does not want to race in the IndyCar series full time.
He just wants to do Indy.
Yeah, he's kind of where that third car comes in. It's probably just going to be Indy, and it's probably just going to be Alonso in the third car.
And one other person that we have not discussed yet, because we know that before this deal was done, Schmidt-Peterson Motorsports made a promise to one man that when he is ready and able to come back, Robert Wickens will have a car ready for him to drive. And that commitment will still carry on through the new partnership, which is good to see. Because, man, if they had broken off that partnership, that would have been just terrible PR. The worst.
Yeah. And as always and forever, there is only one Robert Wickens.
Absolutely. That's going to be really interesting, because with that partnership, you know, McLaren or not, they can't get embarrassed the way they did last time out.
We can't be going through the article having Dre having a mental breakdown as he reads each sentence.
Not with that many resources.
Yeah, this is combining one of the, really an upper tier team in IndyCar with a team of the resources of McLaren. And with an engine which is pretty good considering what Simon Pagenaud did with it this year.
Yeah, and all things considered, it does help tilt the balance of power, which was kind of getting skewed towards Honda's side, where basically Chevrolet had Penske and nobody else to work with. Now they do have another upper-tier team with which they can pull resources from. I like this move.
Yeah, I just can't wait to see...
I feel otherwise. I'm very iffy about this move. I think it might lead to a situation where there might be too many cooks trying to maneuver this massive McLaren Schmidt Peterson boat. Like, John Flack, Tony Keel, Sam Smith, and Rick Peterson have done a great job so far. But now you're throwing in both Jill LaFerrin and Zach Brown. And it's clear based on the conference call that they had to announce the deal. Zach Brown does have some kind of executive control over this team.
Noted purchaser of steering wheels, Zach Brown.
And Jill LaFerrin, a guy who's won back-to-back national championships and an Indianapolis 500, I would hope he would be able to be a competent leader of the team.
Do we need to discuss Jill LaFerrin's own foray into team ownership?
Oh, yeah, I think
hey,
I remember that.
Hey, he gave us Simon Pagenaud. That is the only thing that he gave us.
So that will be something to watch. Let's cut back to some minor F1 stories here. First, Mexico is back on the calendar. But wait, hold on. I'm seeing Mexico City? The Mexico City Grand Prix.
Oh, they're not going away. They got the deal done.
Autódromo Hermanos Rodríguez on the calendar through 2022. We were worried that the Mexican Grand Prix might fall off, but the Mexican Grand Prix is no more. Long live La Grande Premio de Ciudad de México!
Oof. And that also segues into another story that's mentioned where Mercedes-Benz has officially stated that they won't interfere on whether Liberty Media chooses to have or not have the German Grand Prix next year.
Yeah, so in other words, if the German Grand Prix is coming back, it's not going to be because Mercedes are footing the bill. You think, yeah, they'd think they would have been different if they had won the race instead of having two massive fuck-ups at the German Grand Prix?
The token Mercedes meltdown race of the year. Chernobyl size.
God. Oof. But yeah, I've heard it discussed, like, well, it makes sense that it's a Mexico City Grand Prix and not the Mexico Grand Prix because, hey, it's not the United Arab Emirates that pays for the race in Yas Marina. It's Abu Dhabi.
Yeah, that does make sense. That does.
Yeah, a little. King, what's this about synthetic fuels?
Well, the boys up over at Liberty Media feel like a not enough is being made of F1's extremely efficient engines, and they are hoping to launch a PR campaign to push F1's green credentials. And they are going to be working with a number of petrochemical companies that are already within F1 to invest in developing synthetic fuels.
You know, not breaking up the travel so that way you're not traveling as much with overseas freight, or, you know, helping to develop a more fuel-efficient way to travel, to carry the freight overseas. No. More synthetic fuels!
More synthetic fuels. So, for those who don't know, synthetic fuels is... they're still technically fossil fuels, but obviously they're not, you know, drilled and refined like traditional synthetic fuels. They're, you know, refined in a laboratory. And pretty much technically on paper it is green, but they still emit carbon dioxide just like any other fuel. But here's the catch here. You can develop synthetic fuel from captured CO2 that was captured from the atmosphere. So technically, it's renewable.
This is all very fascinating. And I'm sure because it's all, because some people will hear the words alternative fuel and eco-friendly, F1 anoraks will fucking hate it. Even if it'll have no actual...
We need a V10 engines and we need to put so many things in the fuel! Come on, people!
Listen, I won't support F1 until they start adding rolling coal diesel engines into this sport.
Oh my god.
Audi Sport has entered the chat.
So basically, in short, the most green part about synthetic fuel isn't the fuel itself. It's the fact that the way it's developed is green, and the fact that it reuses carbon that was captured from the atmosphere, obviously... it's obviously a very good thing.
I thought it was just because it was dyed green. When you pour it, it's just like it's a green color, kind of like how royal purple is purple.
Oh lord. So, surprisingly enough, actual gasoline has like a yellowish tint to it. Synthetic fuel is perfectly clear like water.
Yo, we could get the rainbow of fuels just like we had the rainbow of tires a couple of years ago.
Oh my goodness!
We see the Ferrari being fueled up with the prime fuel.
Yes, going with the option fuel.
Speaking of Ferrari and fuel, rumors point to Ferrari introducing their third power unit spec at Spa, in conjunction with the new fuel from Shell, could potentially bring up to 20 horsepower, and more importantly, might help their fuel consumption because oh my god!
Yeah. It ain't good, Chief. Let's talk about Penske. Jay Penske, who made a very good decision with his Formula E team. He was rumored to be joining the Porsche Formula E squad. That all fell to the wayside when they signed Andre Lotterer, but Brendan Hartley is coming to Formula E in 2019-20 with Giot's Dragon Racing.
The heart attack returns.
The heart attack returns.
That should not be as much of a pleasant hashtag as it sounds.
Brendan's credentials, of course. Two-time World Endurance Champion. Le Mans winner. Really deserved better opportunities in F1 than the one that he got. It's going to be great to see him back in top-level single-seater competition with a team that on their day can achieve good things, and it's really about making huge steps forward with Dragon Racing, which, given their history in IndyCar, it can be a little challenging at times.
Yeah, keep the Lotus engines for yourself.
Matt C. Gunther did well with them.
And also, in Related note, a spokesperson for Toyota Gazoo Racing has told the outlet eRacing 365 that in the event that there are any clashes between the WEC and Formula E, Brendan Hartley will have to give priority to his WEC commitments.
Yeah, because he's driving for the factory team here. It's the factory that pays his salary. I don't have a problem with that at all. Go rack yourself up a third title. Hell, it's not like you're going to have much competition outside of your own teammates.
But guys, Rebellion.
Man.
They said they want to compete with more than just the Ginettas.
They got Norman Nato.
They got hybrid power.
Yeah. But they do have a multinational peacekeeping coalition driving for them. King, happy birthday. KTM's all over the news in MotoGP.
And not for the reasons you want them to be.
The good. KTM are committing to MotoGP long-term through the 2025 season. The bad.
Let's get it.
The bad. They're pulling out of Moto2 as a chassis supplier at the end of this year. The interesting? After bringing in Johann Zarco from Tech 3 Yamaha this year, the deal is off after just one season, and Johann Zarco will not be racing for them in 2020.
Oh.
That's a lot to unpack. I'm glad they're going to be in the series long term.
I am glad, too. I'm glad, too. They had a...
Sucks that they're pulling out of Moto2.
Yeah, but the thing is, though, I understand it would make sense for them to focus their efforts on the MotoGP side when all they can do is just build a chassis for Moto2 because the engines are all spec. Zarco is the one that confuses me. Now, I heard from sources close to the paddock... Very, very close to the paddock, as a matter of fact.
Don't imply things. Don't imply things.
No.
What are you talking about? I got Tony Moody and David Emmett on speed dial and nobody else.
Oh, cool. Yes. Cool.
So Johan and KTM apparently have not meshed very well, shall we say. It's not been a good partnership. Zarco's not been happy, and he's largely been outperformed by Paul Espargaro. Counterpoint, Paul Espargaro is a very damn fine rider in his own right. The thing that upsets me is that Johann Zarco doesn't have many other places to go. The grid's almost full for 2020, and it's looking like his best option if he wants to race at all is to go from MotoGP in underwhelming equipment to World Superbike in underwhelming equipment, because the rumor is he might have been going to Honda in World Superbikes. And this is a man who had pace to win races on satellite Yamahas just 2 years ago.
Who left the satellite Yamaha teams to try and lead the charge for a factory up-and-coming team in KTM.
Right. So, I mean, I get that it's not a good fit, but it doesn't... It just seems wrong that a guy that talented is either going to have to not race next year or is going to have to slog through finishing anywhere from 11th to 15th in World Superbikes.
Yeah, and... It looks a little bit more like this was Zarco's decision rather than KTM's, right, according to quite a few people around the sport that, yeah, Zarco's relationship with KTM has completely collapsed.
It's sad that it hasn't worked out. On the other hand, you know, given its performance in Austria, and we'll get into that a bit, but KTM's got... options for the future. I mean, Brad Binder's coming up to Tech 3, and Miguel Oliveira's been so good this year with Tech 3.
Yeah, and the rumor is that Oliveira will be the person replacing Johann Zarco.
Oliveira and Espargaro, that is a team.
And all this as we're getting other tertiary news around the MotoGP paddock. For one, rumors of Jorge Lorenzo's demise have been greatly exaggerated, at least for one season. He will stay at Honda through the end of his deal in 2020. Jack Miller may be on the move out of Pramac Racing Team at Ducati at the end of this season. And another driver might be leaving the Ducati family. Alvaro Bautista. You know, the guy who was off to a seemingly unassailable lead in World Superbikes with a broken Ducati Panigale World Superbike?
Very seemingly.
Yeah.
It feels like a reverse Alba.
And of all the teams,
The rumors that he's going to Honda.
Honda have to have developed a new bike under cover of night here.
For Honda must have just shown him. They just must have backed up the Brinks truck.
No, they must have just, like, accidentally dropped the portfolio. Like, oops, I'm so sorry that I left this here. Our bike designs.
Our limited 10 production run homologation specials. Oh, no.
Oh, no.
If Jack Viller's on them,
I've also just noticed in the Discord, I think Vic was about to actually go Super Saiyan over that news.
Yeah. So if Miller's on the way out, where does he go and who replaces him?
I don't.
To be determined.
Yeah, because it was looking like it was going to be Lorenzo moving to Pramac Ducati and then a free-for-all for who would get the other Honda seat. I heard it was going to be a straight swap even, Miller for Lorenzo, Pramac to Repsol Honda.
And there was some rumors from the Monolith that Miller could move over to KTM, though the Monolith is reporting that Miller might actually stay put.
Yeah, which would be for the best, because I don't know if Miller would have been the man to pull KTM out of the slump. And I love me some Jack Miller. When he is on his game, he's pretty daggone good.
Yeah.
But he is also doing wonderful things with Pramac Ducati. He's just got to, you know, not low-sided every now and then in important races.
Yeah, that's kind of a requirement in the contract.
Yeah. Alex Marquez has also been a discussion. If he continues his run of form, I feel like he's got to get a MotoGP ride at some point, right?
If Alex can keep up this form, and as we know, that is a big if with Alex Marquez. But if he can, I don't see any reason why he wouldn't potentially get that seat.
All right. Yeah, we got a lot to unpack in MotoGP. So we'll take a quick break, and we'll be back with the help of one friendly neighborhood, Andre Harrison, to discuss the MotoGP Austrian Grand Prix. Here now to discuss all the goings-on of the Grosse Prize von Österreichs presented by whichever multi-level marketing scheme my world is fronting out there, is your friendly neighborhood, Andre Harrison.
Hey guys. Yeah, it's me again, your friendly neighborhood host, Dre, and sadly not here on the live recording, but here via the power of osmosis. Huzzah. Here I am, everybody. I am back to run you through the MotoGP weekend and all the big biking news coming out of the world of two wheels in the past week. I promise I will be back on next week's show. That is a guarantee. Sorry if you've missed me over the last fortnight. This is the best I can do when it comes to making up for it. But I'm here to talk a little bit about MotoGP in Austria, and after that I will get into some of the news as well. We've got a lot to get through, so we'll get right into it. And this is a big one. Austria, like, let's be real here, MotoGP stole the show, and to be fair, I think the sport needed a weekend like this one. I say that because I think some of the more cynically minded motorsport and bike fans out there were getting a little bit sick and tired of Marc Marquez already. After dominating in Brno, a race that he doesn't normally win at, doesn't normally win in the dry, I think everybody was a little bit tired of Marquez just putting away and beating the entire field by a distance. So people were already down on this weekend when he qualified on pole position by 0.4 seconds. Now, I know Austria is a short lap, but to extract that much from the performance of the tyres is mesmerising. He set the all-time fastest ever lap of the Red Bull Ring in Spielberg. He was, like I said, he was 0.4 faster than any other guy on the field. That same 0.4 second he out-qualified second place by, you could have ran that 0.4 down the order, and if you did, you would have gotten to 11th. It's easy to forget, the rest of the field is the closest we've ever seen it in GP, and Marquez absolutely laid waste to them. And that was also significant because it was his 59th pole position in the top flight, which takes him above Mick Doohan and into the all-time lead. when it comes to Premier Class pole positions. That was, like I said, 59, beating Mick Doohan's record of 58. Pretty crazy stuff, if you ask me. Very, very, very fast indeed. I mean, we didn't even talk about it in Brno. It was his 50th top flight win, which made him just the fourth man of the 50 win club, where that's concerned as well. But for the race itself, well, let's just cut to the chase. It was Dovi V. Marquez 6, the newest addition to the Fast and Furious franchise, only nowhere near as disappointing. We almost got into it from turn 3, where Marquez and Dovi both ran wide at the hairpin, and I love that Keith Ewan immediately teased that we were getting a Sepang-like moment, and then he would have to quickly reel himself in when he realised how stupid that fucking sounded. But it dropped them to 4th and 5th on the field, and eventually Marquez and Dovi would pick their way off and get to the front of the queue. They overtook Alex Rins and Fabio Quartararo to do it, and those two, Dovi and Marquez were in a field of their own. Nobody else was even close. They were a good 2-3 tenths of that faster than anybody else on track. Fabio Quartararo was in a very lonely third, which he would actually finish in by the time the race was over. He actually would finish the race in P3, but it was Dovi v Marquez that fought each other out all the way. They were feeling each other out, seeing who was the faster one. You know, Dovi kind of went a bit early. He went about 5 laps out. He started pushing at full speed. Marquez actually passed him down into turn 7. A surprise move at turn 7 with 3 to go to take the lead, and we thought, as Marquez played possum with him the entire time, like it was Aragon from last season. But it's amazing. If you haven't seen it, go out of your way to check out Instagram, because MotoGP put up an interview where I think it was Simon Crafar, Marquez and Dovi with video footage of their final lap and both of them commentating on that final lap from their perspective. It's a fantastic point of view from how the riders saw it themselves. And there's a great scene on the final lap where Marquez has about a 0.4, 0.5 of a second lead on the final lap. He's going into turn 1. He's got through turn 3 cleanly, despite Dovi being the faster bike in a straight line. And Dovi thought the game was over. He thought that was it. He thought he had nothing left in the tank. But Dovi was able to reel Marquez in the twistier second half of the lap. And Dovi wins the race of a last corner lunge, the same last corner lunge that Marquez tried on him 2 years ago, only this time Dovi was able to make it stick. It's amazing. Dovi had virtually no brakes left. He was gone. Marquez, at the outside of turn 9, you can just see the rear wheel spin up a little bit on the entry towards turn 10. I don't think he had quite as much grip to go all out at that final corner and shut the door in Dovi's face. Dovi went for the lunge and he nailed it. He let it drift out on the apex just enough of a distance where Marquez couldn't cut in and try to get back at him. It was another clean, brilliant fight with a clean, brilliant ending, and Dovi makes it 5-1 against Marquez in last lap dogfights. Dovizioso winning the race, just his second win of 2019, but even or not, ahead of Marquez and Quartararo third. Go out of your way to watch this. This is an all-time classic. It's another brilliant Dovi v Marquez exhibition. These two bring out the best in each other. They are magnificent motorcycle riders, and Dovi is like the only man who has Marquez's number over a single lap consistently. It's ridiculous how Dovi keeps pulling this off. It's almost like a blessing and a curse for Marquez all at the same time, because it's kind of amazing how, like, Dovi can occasionally, very occasionally, pull off these superhuman performances, but he's doing it for a grand total of 5 points, because Marquez always finishes in second. And those big those good days, those quote-unquote bad days from Marquez are still more than enough to counter anything that Dovi can throw at him over the course of a season. It's incredible, to say the least. And yeah, it's incredibly impressive stuff. But yeah, those two are 6 seconds faster over the course of that race than anybody else. As mentioned, Fabio Quartararo was third. He was 6 seconds away in third. Shout out to Valentino Rossi. He did a very good job. The Sunday man himself came through again, finished in fourth, beating his teammate Maverick Vinales, who was fast all weekend. He was front row contender all the way through the weekend, but slipped to fifth in the race itself, ahead of Alex Rins, who he beat over the line by 0.02 seconds. That was the Lone Star fight for fourth, but Rossi won that by just over a second in the end. A brilliant race, though, from the front. One you should definitely go out of your way to see. A brilliant race all told. A quick run down to the full result. Andrea Dovizioso winning by 0.2 seconds over Marc Marquez. Fabio Quartararo third. Valentino Rossi fourth, ahead of Maverick Vinales and Alex Rins. Francisco Bagnaia, his best result in MotoGP to date. Seventh place for the Pramac team. A tumultuous time for the Pramac team, but one to definitely keep an eye on going forward. More on that later. He just beat over the line a rampant Miguel Oliveira in eighth. His best performance in GP to date. And top KTM, a brilliant performance from Miguel. All weekend long he'd been very, very fast, and it might reap him some rewards later on in 2020. We'll see again. More on that later. Danilo Petrucci in ninth, nowhere really all weekend. Crashed in qualifying, didn't exactly help his confidence either. Frankie Morbidelli rounding off the top 10 ahead of Taka Nakagami. Johann Zarco in 12th. Stefan Bradl in 13th place. Alicia Spagaro in 14th. Carol Abraham rounding off the points in 15th place, and Andrea Iannone, the last man over the line. He was a lap down in 16th place. Five non-finishers. Tito Rabat crashed out with 8 to go. Jack Miller binned it on his own, which is not ideal, but doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. Hafiz Syrin crashed on lap 2. Paul Espargaro got caught up in a nasty accident with Carl Crutchlow at turn 3 on the opening lap. Paul's bike cut out on the apex. It was slow, it cut out, and there was no power going through it, and then Crutchlow rode into the back of him. Nasty accident. Thankfully, both of them okay in the end, but it could have been very, very nasty indeed. Thankfully, everybody okay as a result of that one. Okay, championship standings as we head to Silverstone next weekend. 8 races to go in the championship. Marc Marquez still leading the way by 58 points over Andrea Dovizioso in second place. He's 36 points ahead of his teammate Danilo Petrucci in third. It's the most quiet third place in the championship I've ever seen in GP. It's really weird. Alex Rins in fourth on 124. Valentino Rossi now overtakes his teammate. Despite the run of 3 crashes in the middle of the season, he's got 103 to Maverick's 102. Fabio Quartararo now on 92 points in 7th, ahead of Jack Miller in 8th on 86. Cal Crutchlow in 9th now on 78 points. And Taka Nakagami in 10th on 62. Like I said, a 10 out of 10 classic. Go out of your way to see it. It was a fantastic Grand Prix. Definitely want to watch again and again. Dovi and Marquez are just brilliant riders and are worthy of your time indeed. Moto2, not so much. It could have had a nice crescendo at the end. It didn't really, unfortunately. It was a little bit rough and tumble. 3 big incidents, which we'll get to later on in the race. But at the front of the field, it was Brad Binder winning for KTM on his 24th birthday. So congrats to Lord Binder on an excellent ride. He pretty much led from start to finish. There was some scrappiness behind him and the guys trying to overtake him, but no one could ever really put a move on him. Alex Marquez tried right at the end of the Grand Prix, couldn't quite manage it, and Alex Marquez would finish in second, but still some very solid 20 championship points for him. Jorge Navarro, another second and a half back in third. He beat Lorenzo Baldassarre over the line in a close run fight for the last of the podium spots. Also worth pointing out, all 3 major chassis manufacturers on the podium this weekend. Cool to see. As I mentioned, Baldassarre in 4th, Augusto Fernandez 5th, Thomas Luthi in 6th, Jorge Martin with a very solid result for the KTM boys in 7th, ahead of Ikel Aquona in 8th, Marcel Schrotter 9th, Matteo Pessini 10th for the Tasca team, ahead of Andrea Locatelli. Somkiat Chandra, who was on the front row to start the weekend, sadly couldn't convert it into a podium finish in race trim, but a very nice performance from him. The first Thai rider on, I think, on the front row of the grid, I think since 2009, I want to say. So great result from them. A nice weekend for the Idemitsu team in that sense. Budiger, Nicolo Budiger in 13th, Fabio Di Giantonio in 14th, and Bo Benschneider rounding off the points in 15th place. The return of Jonas Vogel was in 18th. Jake Dixon, for British interest's sake, was 19th. Sam Lowe's had a miserable weekend. He was down in 24th, but three big incidents in that race. Xavi Vierge slid at turn 4 and took out Tetsuya Nagashima, who had his first career pole position for the Onesox team there at the front of the field. They've been tremendous this year. They've really dramatically improved this year, where Nagashima is constantly in the top 10, and Remy Gardner's had flashes of real brilliance in the intermediate flight. He's not been able to convert it into really big, chunky results consistently yet, but they've really improved. But Nagashima, very sadly, taken out from, I think, what was 4th place at the time. Xavi, to be fair, immediately went into the back and apologised. Classy gesture from the young Spaniard. So keep off an eye on that. Remy Gardner, he got collected. He rode into the back of Alex Marquez's tangled bike after he went ride and then rejoined the track at turn 1, and he ran into the back of Marquez's machine and went down. I love that Gardner sat down in the middle of the track with his arms aloft like, what's going on? And I'm like, dude, you're in a racetrack. Get out of the fucking way. It was crazy. And then poor Enea Bastianini, who was running in the podium positions, and then he was taken out by Luca Marini. Marini slid out at the penultimate corner and then collected the back of Bastianini's bike and flipped him sideways. Bastianini was literally walking in midair before he hit the deck. It looked like he might have broken his ankle, but thankfully he was declared fit afterwards. So thankfully, again, no harm done, but three nasty incidents there. A fun Moto2 race, not a classic by any stretch, but still an excellent race indeed. Again, certainly worth checking out. And congrats to Alex Marquez, who confirmed he's going to be staying with the Mark VDS team next year. Looks like there was rumours around that he might have been going to Petronas next year with the promise of a MotoGP seat in 2021. Apparently his brother Mark has been teasing him into joining the Yamaha because he thinks it'll be a better fit for his riding style. But apparently Lynn Jarvis vetoed the deal. Apparently, the Marquez brothers will never be allowed to race a Yamaha after what happened in Sepang in 2015. Nudge, nudge. Wink, wink. Again, read into that what you will. There's a lot of big, silly season stuff going down in Moto2. A lot of guys jostling for position. Baldassare staying alongside Fernandez. Marquez is staying with Mark VDS. It looks like Sam Lowes could be his teammate next season with Vierge out. So keep half an eye on that in the coming weeks as those deals get done and wrapped up. Keep an eye on the papers. Moto3, another dramatic Moto3 race of a very popular winner. Yes, it's Romano Fenati. Yes, that Romano Fenati, the guy who went viral for nearly killing someone in Moto2 last season. A popular winner, as I'm sure you'll attest. It was an interesting race. It started patchy. I mean, it was a dry race, but with a lot of wet surface to play with. A lot of guys, you couldn't really race off the racing line. It was very dangerous, and I'm actually quite annoyed by that in Moto3, because when that happens, it tends to split the field up a bit, and that's exactly what happened here. There was chunks of riders on the circuit, but the three guys who broke off initially was Romano Fenati, his teammate for the Snipers team, Tony Arbolino, and John McPhee, who'd qualified on pole after 18 penalties were handed out in qualifying. 16 of them, believe it or not, were from, I believe it was dawdling on the racing line, you know, basically riding too slowly on outlaps and inlaps. That rule's been clamped down on hard in Moto 2 and Moto 3. You're not allowed to dawdle along the racing line, and that's exactly what happened to literally half the field, and the grid got completely jumbled up. In the end, it was found out that John McPhee would start from pole, and we were all just okay with that, basically. But that was the leading group of three. As the race went on in the latter stages, Romano Fenati was able to break the toe. Some sloppy racemanship from Arbolino and McPhee. They were too busy fighting each other. They didn't realise that Fenati was getting away, and by the time he broke the toe, Arbolino and McPhee were fighting so hard they couldn't pull him back in till the end, and by that point it was too late. Fenati winning the race by just over a second ahead of his teammate. But to put it into perspective, just 23 thousandths of a second separating second and being off the podium. Celestino Vietti was in the lead of the chasing group, trying to get up to the front, and it was him and Jao Masia that was trying to get to that leading group after breaking off at the start. Masia fell in the latter stages, but Vietti got with the group fighting for the podium, and he was the unlucky one. I believe he was second coming off the final corner, but lost out in the drag race and the exit to the finish line. He'd end up finishing in fourth, as I said, 23 thousandths off a second place finish. He ends up finishing in fourth instead. Marcos Ramirez bested the rest in fifth place, 6 seconds away ahead of Lorenzo Dalla Porta in sixth, important for the title race, which I'll get to in a minute. Makar Yuchenko in seventh place, a good result for him and the Skull Rider Mugen team as well. Jumpman Cornfile in eighth. Nicolo Antonelli in ninth, ahead of Aaron Canet in tenth. Albert Arenas 11th. Ayagura in 12th. Ayumu Sasaki in 13th for the Petronas team. Dennis Foggia in 14th. And Darren Binder 15th for the Green Power CIP team, rounding off the points. I didn't get through Toto 2's championship standings, by the way, so I'll get to those real quick in case you were wondering where they happened. Due to the nature of the race, and again, another 20 solid points for Marquez, he now leads the championship by 43 points ahead of Thomas Luthi. Jorge Navarro is now third on 126 points in third. Augusto Fernandez fourth on 121. Lorenzo Baldassarre 5th on 115, he's a point ahead of Marcel Schrotter on 114. Brad Binder, who very quietly has now scored, I want to say, 65 points in the last four rounds. I think only Marquez has scored more in the last four rounds. KTM having a bit of a sudden resurgence in the second half of the season yet again. Binder on 109 now in 7th. He's 8 points ahead of Luca Marini in 8th. Bastianini 9th on 74. And Fabio Di Giantonio in 10th on 59 points. In Moto3, I mentioned that 6th was important for Dalla Porta because he's now taken the lead of the Moto3 Championship again by a single point over Aaron Canet, 155 to 154. Arbolino's starting to reel him in a little bit though, 20 points for him. He's up to 113 now in 3rd, ahead of Nicolo Antonelli in 4th, Marcos Ramirez in 5th on 89, John McPhee on 84 in 6th, Celestino Vietti in 7th on 81, Jao Masia with 78 in 8th place, Romano Fenati, now 9th in the championship, have fun with that, ahead of Jakob Kornfile in 10th place on countback. They both have 67 points. So, yeah, one more series to get through as well. We had Moto E this weekend return for its second round of the championship, despite the minor scare of another paddock fire. Luckily, this one was put out quickly and dealt with rather than the disaster that led to the delay of this season in the first place. So thankfully, we were able to get everything under control and there was no damage to the weekend schedule. It was Mike Domeglio that qualified on pole by 11 thousandths of a second, but he would go on to win the 5-lap Austria E-Prix. Is it an E-Prix? Do they call it that, MotoE? Moto E World Cup race, whatever you want to call it. Ahead of Xavier Simeon, he finished in second, 2.2 seconds behind. Bradley Smith in third, continuing his strong run of form. He's their third on 4.3 seconds behind. He was ahead of Alex De Angelis, Matteo Ferrari, Sete Gibernau, Josh Hook, Jesko Raffin, Nicolo Canepa, and Lorenzo Savadori rounding off the top 10. A bit of a dramatic one at the end with Eric Granado crashing from the podium spots in the early going, and then Hector Garzo, who was second, trying to make a run for the win, but he binned it at the turn 4 right-hand downhill, lost the front and tucked it completely. I'm enjoying Moto E for what it's worth. It's very fun. It's short. It's sharp. It's like putting a... It's like double strength concentrate dilutable. It's very fun in short doses. For a 5-lap race, it's very, very cool indeed. Very fun. You can hear so much more of the bikes, the knee sliders, the tires gripping. It's a great time. I highly recommend going out of your way to see it. It's well worth a watch. So, yeah. It's a shame the races are still so short, but hopefully that will improve in time. But a fun Moto E race indeed, as far as I'm concerned. Very, very fun. Definitely keep watching it if you can. Mike Domeglio taking the championship lead by 5 points ahead of Bradley Smith on 36 and Xavier Simeon on 29. If you haven't seen the news already, look out for Bradley Smith. He'll be wildcarding for the Petronas team for the Idemitsu team in Moto 2 at Silverstone next weekend. Idan Powie is still riding hurt, unfortunately. His injury is a bit more complicated than first feared. Hopefully he'll be back on a motorcycle soon, but Bradley Smith is the latest rider to fill in from a wildcard standpoint at the weekend, which is great to hear. So great to see Bradley back in the main GP paddock. Great to see. Now, this almost played second fiddle to a lot of news that dropped over the course of the weekend. A lot of it silly season related. It was a wild one. Silly season 2, when it all dropped on Thursday, when Jack Miller admitted there was actually an element of truth to some of the press rumours going around that Jorge Lorenzo was talking at Brno about trying to maybe get on the Pramac seat and jettison Honda at the end of the season to get on a fully factory-supported Pramac GP20 next year. And Jack Miller being the casualty of that seat. And it was actually very sad for Miller. It was a rough weekend in that Miller not only crashed during the race, but also welled up to the point of tears. Basically talking about these rumours and how unsettled he was in the situation. Pramac had told Miller from day one they wanted to keep him for next year. That was always the plan, and the plan almost got yanked out from underneath him, but Ducati did send over the contract after the race weekend. I can confirm Miller will be there for Pramac on the GP20 next year. So great for Jack Miller, who's had 2 podiums, a very strong season, definitely his best in GP to date, and one that I think he could easily kick on from going forward in the future, especially if Petrux is looking this mediocre at the moment. So, Jorge Lorenzo openly, the team admitted that his team was admitting they'd shopped with Pramac. They were offering their services to Petronas. Petronas were not interested. They made it absolutely clear, we have no plans to sign Jorge Lorenzo, basically. And yeah, Lorenzo is out here probably breaking his trust with the Honda unit, but Honda, he's staying with him for 2020. That's absolutely dead certain. Lorenzo is staying put with Honda for 2020, but he's making a bit of a Hornets of it. Let's put it that way, to say the least. But that was like the silver medal prize. In another words, chaotic week. Because KTM shit as well and truly hit the fan. Johann Zarco is quitting the team at the end of the season, and maybe even as soon as next weekend at Silverstone. It's gotten ugly at KTM. Zarco apparently spoke to the team with tears in his eyes. He hated this. Zarco is, for those guys who don't know, Johann Zarco is a very emotional guy, apparently. He's very much a heart-on-your-sleeve sort of guy. He leaves himself under no illusions. He's very emotional when it comes to his riding. He's very delicate mentally. He's very sensitive, and he's not liked the way it's gone. Apparently fallouts between him and the engineers, and generally put, his riding style, which is very smooth and very smooth and very Yamaha-y, very characteristically Yamaha, high apex, high cornering speed, very smooth lines, very fast. But the KTM is more of a brute. It likes to be chucked in and thrown around. That's why it's better suited Pol Espargaró. That's not Zarco's riding style. And the KTM had no problem throwing some shade at Zarco on the way out, saying that, the engineers had tried everything to try and, make Zarco more comfortable with the bike and the provisions that he asked for. But at the same time, they also dropped in the little line about Pol Espargaró regularly challenging for top 10s. ouch. And that's the worst part. If you're Johann Zarco now, what do? You've got nowhere else to go. It's a sticky one, because now every other major seat in GP is now filled. The 2020 grid is more or less confirmed. Taka Nakagami, I believe, is the only rider not to have a new deal for 2020, and apparently that will be wrapped up in the coming days. So Zarco, he might have to go back to Moto2, but the problem with that is that a lot of the top seats in Moto2 are also taken up by a lot of their current riders, like Baldassare and Marquez and Sam Lowes and Thomas Luthi. They're already confirmed for next year as well. So Zarco might have to end up being maybe a test rider, offering the services to somebody else in the hopes that something opens up for 2021. But the way I see it, once you're out of the GP paddock, it's very hard to get back in. And I think Zarco's going to have a real hard time of it. And if you're basically bailing on your contract after two-thirds of a season, when you're on a two-year deal for most riders, with the entire free agent market opening up next year, it's messy. And Zarco's going to have a real hard time. His future's going to be very much hanging by a thread. It'll be interesting to see how that goes down, but it's not going to be ideal, to say the least. Speaking of which, KTM in general is going for a bit of a reshuffle. They confirmed that they'll be committed to MotoGP through the 2023 season. So they're going to be there for at least another 5 years. That's great to hear. They'll be still going to have, as it stands, six manufacturers in the MotoGP paddock, which is great. But it comes at a cost. Their Moto2 team is gone. They'll be pulling out of Moto2 at the end of the season. And Husqvarna, their Supermoto motocross brand, will be back in the Moto3 team instead going forward. I still believe that IO will get a bike in support, but it looks like KTM's going for a right shake-up, which is very interesting, to say the least. It's a real shame. KTM, I think, has gotten most of what it can get out of its current crop of riders that's come up through the ladder. We know Brad Binder is moving up next year into the Tech 3 team. It's looking like Efees Syrin will be out, and it looks like Miguel Oliveira might get bumped up to the main factory team alongside Pol Espargaró next season. Oliveira could be the one to benefit. But KTM are taking their time when it comes to finding a replacement. We'll see what they do in the coming days and weeks, but we don't know for sure what's going on with that just yet. KTM, big reshuffle, but Zarco is on the way out. Sad to hear, because Zarco is a talented, talented rider who can absolutely challenge for wins and podiums on his best days. But I still think him going to KTM was a terrible idea, and he should never have done that in the first place. And he's now, I think, kind of locked himself into pain here, no matter what happens. Bit of World Superbike silly season news as well. It was confirmed today, on August 16th, the night I'm recording this, that Eugene Laverty will be leaving the Barney Aruba Ducati team at the end of the season. They'll be going to BMW. Alongside Tom Sykes for the 2020 season, it looks like he's going to replace Marcus Reiterberger. So it looks like the BMW team's taking a nice little upgrade. I mean, Tom Sykes and Eugene Laverty is a very strong team indeed. And a great signing for BMW to get one of the better guys in the field. A guy who has won races in WSBK, who was, you know, a very strong MotoGP runner in his prime as well. And hopefully some stability for Laverty, who's been all over the place in the last 2 years, battling injury, battling factory bikes, and trying to get his foot in the door with the big boys again in the series. So great to hear for Eugene Laverty. Still a lot of future up in the air for Ducati. They've made it quite clear. They want Scott Redding next year, who's currently in the fight for the British Superbike Championship right now with PBM. He's now in a dogfight over there, and they've made it clear they want Scott Redding. It looks like Bautista is all but gone. It looks like he's going to be going to the Honda, the new Red Bull factory Honda project that they've got going on. It looks like they'll be debuting a brand new Fireblade from scratch next year, and they want Bautista to lead the way in that. Bold, I'll say that much at least. More to come from that soon. Still a lot of talk about Kawasaki as well, and who will be alongside Jonathan Rea next year. It could be Leon Haslam, who's been a very good boy, very obedient, very ticking all the boxes for Kawasaki. Maybe winning the Suzuka 8 Hours might save Haslam, because Toprak is knocking on the door, apparently. So, more on that as we get it coming soon. And one more freakish story to come out of BSB as well. Danny Kent, the former Moto3 world champion, arrested and given a 4-month suspended prison sentence for carrying a knife. Now, this is a crazy story. It debuted at BBC Bristol yesterday, and the headline is Danny Kent, world champion rider, admits carrying knife during scuffle. Danny Kent, or Daniel Kent as his real name is, 25, pleaded guilty at Cheltenham Magistrates Court to possessing the knife in a public place. He admitted having the kitchen knife in West Street car park in Tetbury on March 7th. This was before the season even started. This was back in March when he was involved in a scuffle with a 63-year-old man. The sportsman received a 4-month jail sentence suspended for 12 months. He was also ordered to pay £115 in victim surcharge and £85 costs. Prosecuting Peter Ashby said the 63-year-old had been out walking his dog when he heard commotion in a block of flats and saw two men run past him. He added, one of the men, the defendant's brother, confronted the 63-year-old and there was a scuffle and the older man took the young man to the ground. Get in there, big fella. He pinned him down and then the other man, the defendant, came over and pushed the older man off. The witness then saw a knife on the ground. He picked it up and went home and then informed the police. Kent of Webb Road, Tetbury, told officers that he and his brother were collecting a debt, but he would not have used the knife, which had a 6-inch blade. Yes, he had the knife in his pocket, but it was not for any improper purpose. He uses it to open boxes in connection with his work. Kent said, I would like to apologise to the court. I don't know what to say on this one. I mean, from a cultural standpoint, you don't carry a knife by accident. You don't carry a kitchen knife by accident, especially one with a 6-inch blade. That's not short. That can kill somebody if used in the wrong way. You don't take a knife out of you by accident. You just don't. I think Danny's full of shit, to be honest with you. You don't bring a knife with the intention not to use it. I think that's ridiculous. And why would he be box opening at his job? He's a motorcycle racer. What boxes is he opening? Isn't that somebody else's job? It's a real shame, because I remember interviewing Danny Kent back when I was a part of Bike Live on Downforce Radio, and this was 2 days after he'd just become the first British GP world champion since 1977. And, you know, we were full of beans. We were excited that Kent had finally got his shit all together. And it's just been one blow after another in his career ever since. He went up to Moto2 again. He passed on MotoGP seats with Pramac to, you know, go to Moto2. And basically he got outclassed by Miguel Oliveira on the Leopard team when they moved into Moto2. Oliveira had the more impressive performances. Kent went back, was bobbing up and down between Moto2 and 3, taking wildcards left and right, and then quit the Chiesa team as well, and then threw the Chiesa team under the bus in an interview with Susie Perry on BT Sport. It was a mess, and it was ugly, and it kind of proved that Kent maybe can't be trusted. I remember the main line that was being fed around at the time was, talent is not enough regarding Kent. And that's kind of been the story of his career, really. It's a one where he's a talented kid, but his attitude has often sucked. And it looks like what 25-year-old world champion bike racer is out here debt collecting? Just a bizarre and kind of sad story, really. He was sacked from his MV Agusta British Superbike ride at the weekend on the news that he'd been convicted. And I think MV did the right thing. You can't have a convicted criminal represent your team or your brand. I think it's a terrible look. And you can't be doing that. So, yeah, he's sacked. He's without a job again. I'm sure he'll pop up somewhere else. The man can ride a Moto3 bike very well. That's been proven. So, hey, maybe someone else in the grid can pick him up. I mean, if it worked for Romano Fenati, there's hope for everybody here. Just saying. But, hey, I've been talking now for pretty much half an hour straight. So let me get out of here. Hope you guys enjoyed my little segment there. Oh, just before I go, Vic asked me a question on Twitter, and he said, if Lorenzo doesn't stay with Repsol Honda, can you see him moving to World Superbikes, and who would be most likely to ride for it if he did make the switch? He's staying put, so don't worry about that, Vic. But thanks for the question anyway, my friend. Much appreciated. You can follow me on Twitter, Harrison101HD, and our website, motorsport101.com. Of course, I'm on YouTube as well, youtube.com/motorsport101. Put up a nice new Dre brief as well regarding Pierre Gasly and his demotion at Red Bull, which I'm sure the boys have already spoken about by now on the show itself. And without further ado, I'll hand you back to those guys. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Sayonara.
Thank you, Dre. Man, this was a good one. I'm so glad I got up to watch this and watch that final lap, final corner pass.
I'm so mad I missed as much of the race as I did, but I did get to see the final few laps, and what a duel.
Oh, my goodness. Can I just say for the record, Scott McLaughlin, you know, the namesake of our Scott McLaughlin Award, the Scotty Award for the best overtake of the season, if he said there was an amazing pass, I'd say, fuck it, let's just give Dobby the trophy right now. Why even wait to December for us to do the award show? Let's just give him that trophy now.
Oh, it's only the one on two wheels.
What, are we doing two and four wheel versions of this now?
Actually, wouldn't be a bad idea.
The award shows are already 3 hours long. That would actually be a good idea. But yes, that was a good race. I was really impressed with how Quartararo held on for as much as he could, considering his Yamaha is powered by 30 hamsters.
Yeah, this is the anti. If this track is what that suits the Ducati, this is the anti-Yamaha track.
It really is. It really is.
Most important thing, Ducati remain unbeaten at Fortress Ducati.
Last corner yeet from Andrea Dovizioso to take the win from a rampant Marc Marquez, who's just been dominating this part of the season, got pulled by over 0.4.
Yeah, not just any pole, the record premier class pole position that put him ahead of Mick Doohan.
He was trying to go for a 121.
Good lord.
Or 122, I should say.
Quartararo finished in third. Yamaha 345. Quartararo Rossi Vinales. And once again, it's the satellite Yamaha bloodying the nose of the factory Yamahas.
I feel like I've seen this before.
And most importantly, Miguel Oliveira finished eighth in a satellite KTM at home.
Yeah, and what is not a good look for the now exiting Zarco, that happened.
Yeah, Zarco ended up finishing 12th, which, you know, all things considered, wasn't that bad until you consider, you know, Crutchlow fell, Espargaro fell, Siren fell, Miller fell, Rabat fell, Iannone finished a lap down.
And points go down to 50!
Yeah. Yeah, MotoGP's Mendoza line, Carol Abraham, got in the points, just by matter of attrition. But King, your boy won in Moto2 for the first time since Australia 2018!
Yeah, let's forget about the other news that weekend in Moto2, because this was what really mattered.
Brad Binder did it. You know, depending on who you ask, you might have just think, well, he just won the same event 2 years in a row, because he won Australia last year. And then you realize you just made the common mistake of confusing Australia with Austria.
Common mistake.
Also, Remy Gardner was very lucky not to have his foot smashed. Did you see that ISO shot of him getting up on his bike just as another bike is passing him and almost clipped him on the foot?
I saw that. Yep. I felt that.
Oh, goodness gracious. Yeah, that was again, he was very lucky to have gotten away from that one as well as he did. And Moto3, yes, Romano Fenati is back on the top step of the podium for the first time in a long time. The Snipers team got a 1-2 finish.
Woo.
Do we have strong thoughts?
Woo, I guess.
Good for him.
Yeah, good for him.
Still kind of a cunt.
Yeah. I mean, granted. I don't know, man. I feel like it's tricky because, on the other hand, he did do something very, very terribly dangerous and irresponsible and stupid, and it's not the first time. On the other hand, would people have been more forgiving of him if, you know, let's say, you know, we beat somebody up away from the track?
Probably not.
Yeah.
But not at the same time, I mean, it's one thing doing something stupid and dangerous. It's another to repeat the mistake.
Also, we have one point in this championship with Lorenzo De La Porta and Aaron Canet. I want to move on to that. And also, Moto E is back, baby! The heavyweights are in action!
And, oh my god, one of the bikes caught on fire again.
It's lit! Thankfully, it was only one of the bikes and not the whole box of bikes.
Thank god! Oh, I saw that headline like, not again, no!
This bike is on fire! And so was Mike DiMeglio. Got the pole, the fastest lap, led every lap, and won the race. A dominant ride for the Frenchman ahead of Xavier Simeone and Bradley Smith, rounding off the podium with just four races and two meetings left in this truncated Moto E World Cup. Now, of course, next week, MotoGP, Moto 2, and Moto 3 will be back at the British Grand Prix in Silverstone, the first since the resurfacing. I wonder if we'll get the race going this time.
Please
don't be canceled.
You know it. Please. You know that race was bad when noted permanently wet weather country Britain can't have a fucking bike race. That's how bad it is. That's how bad you fucked this up.
Oh, yeah. Like, hopefully it goes off without a hitch this year. There'll probably be a lot of cameras on hand, considering that GoPro is now the title sponsor of the British Grand Prix.
And remember, if you have any complaints about the quality of the race, be sure to tweet at @aggregate_UK.
Yes, at @aggregate_UK. It is 100% their fault.
Yes.
I can't. Do I have to say allegedly? I don't think I do.
Nope. It is fact. It is their fault.
Oh, man. Continuing our theme of Ryan Eric King birthday celebration, after this quick musical interlude, we'll be back to discuss the brand finale, the W Series of Brands Hatch. DTM was there too, and so was Adam Johnson.
And he got a really sick diecast out of it.
God, I know. I'm so fucking jealous. After a year of skepticism, curiosity, and intrigue, the first ever W Series has come to a close. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. Happy birthday. Happy birthday. I'm too white to sing this version of the song. Alice Powell won the race. Jamie Chadwick won the title. This was Chadwick's worst race of the season. It was still good enough with a fourth place finish to clinch the title by 10 points over Bietz Gewisser, who finished in third. King, it was a very good season for one of your favorite drivers and really a really fantastic talent. Jamie Chadwick, of course, I knew her from back before all of this even happened, back when she was an Aston Martin Young GT driver, winning the GT4 title in British GT. And that's when I really started to pay attention, like, whoa, this girl's really, really good. And as it turns out, good enough to beat a field of 18 to 20 really top-quality women drivers who were all competing for not just for the title, but also, keep in mind, this year's top 12 automatically qualify for next season. There's nothing guaranteed beyond that. So that was something interesting to follow.
And technically, everyone in the field mathematically had a chance of finishing in the top 12.
Yeah. So this race really started to turn because Jamie Chadwick took pole position, got a pretty good start out of her end. But with about 10 minutes elapsed in the race, Alice Powell and Emma Kimmelainen, who were chasing her down in second and third, made a move past Jamie Chadwick, and that opened the door for Vissa to get along side by side. And man, it looked like for a while the two were going to go make contact into one of the corners.
Oh my!
Thankfully,
God,
they did
yeah.
not. Thankfully, they did not.
They went, down that back straight. The Pilgrims Drop. They were side by side all the way down through. Into Hawthorne's, where it's like, man, please, Mike Hawthorne, don't fuck me over from behind the grave today. Please don't.
Right.
All that shit talking. He hears you, King.
Because it would have been one thing for Chadwick to lose the title in the final race. I wouldn't have wanted to see it decided by an incident between the two. I wouldn't have wanted to see that with how much they'd come through this. And give a shout-out to Alice Powell. Well, if not for back-to-back DNFs at Misano and Norris Ring, she would have been right back in this. She never finished worse than third all season.
Yep.
But it was Jamie Chadwick who took the title, 110 points to Wiecka Visser's 100. It was very refreshing to see that some of the women in this field could actually stand a chance. And it wasn't just going to be a one-woman show. Though Chadwick, again, this was probably her worst race. And it was still more than enough to clinch the title.
Which is insane when you think about it.
Yeah. Emma Kimmelainen completing the podium in second place. And you have to wonder, if not for the injuries she sustained at the Hockenheim Ring that put her out Zolder and Misano, where would she have been in this title fight?
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the story of the season. Due to it being short, it kind of... I wouldn't
way
say
too short. It feels like started a few weeks ago.
It didn't leave drivers enough time to recover if they had one bad race.
Yeah.
Yeah, it leaves more questions than answers, where you feel like a lot of people throughout this whole field had a lot of speed, but not enough time to show it.
Yeah, that's very true. We had five different championship race winners. We had a reverse grid winner, which we'll get to in a minute, but man, just some all-around fantastic performances. What about the battle for qualifying for next season? Because it came down to just a single point in the end between the last woman to qualify, Jessica Hawkins, who was in tears realizing that she qualified, over Caitlin Wood just below the cut in 13th, and Goja Rodes 2 points back in 14th.
Yeah, both Sabre Cook and Jessica Hawkins were outside the top 12 going into this race.
That is incredible, and spare a thought for Megan Gilkes, who won the reverse grid Jamie Chadwick Disinvitational, but that was her only top 10 finish of the season, and it didn't count for points. Her and Sarah Bovee were the only drivers not to score, and Shea Holbrook as well. Those were the only three. Miki Koyama had a shocking race at Brands Hatch, bringing out the safety car, trying to do a spin turn. Oh my goodness.
I mean, Koyama's day didn't get off to a good start, where she had to take that drive through for the way she lined up in the grid spot. Like, she was clearly trying to avoid, you know, not rolling down the hill, but she went too far forward.
Esme Hawkey had a drive through penalty of her own, and that arguably could have cost her a place in the top 12.
Yep, where the rest of the field behind her were very skillful to avoid her stalled car.
Yeah, she stalled because she realized she jumped the start. In an attempt to correct the issue, the car just flat out stalled on her.
Yeah, it should be very happy we didn't get a Sebastian Savedra incident.
Oof. So the 12 drivers that have qualified for the 2020 W Series: Jamie Chadwick, of course, Wiecka Visser, Alice Powell, Marta Garcia, Emma Kimmelainen, Fabienne, The Whirlwind, Volwend, Miki Koyama, Sarah Moore, Vicky Puria, Tasman Pepper, Sabre Cook, and Jessica Hawkins.
And it should be noted, just because they finished in the top 12 and qualified for next season doesn't mean they're obligated to return for next season.
Let's talk about it, because Jamie Chadwick is by far, on a consistent basis, the best talent in that series. And one of the things that the W Series was meant to do is that, yes, there are women here who have not raced in a long time getting an opportunity to race, but you have to feel like this series, in order to be a success, would have to get someone a meaningful pathway into Formula One. Now, Chadwick is already partially there because she does have a development driver role with Williams, but at the same time, many other drivers have had development driver roles with other teams, and that has not gotten them anywhere close to an F1 seat.
Well, I guess that's what the money's for. She's now $500 million richer.
I would hope it would be enough to at least... I'll tell you what, it's got to be Formula 2 or Formula 3 at the absolute minimum for her next season.
Yeah, I gut feeling, I'd say expect to see her in the International Formula 3 Championship next year.
Which would be really, really awesome to see. And if the Williams deal does not work out... She does still have those ties with Aston Martin, and I gotta say, Aston, if you're considering drivers for your hypercar program,
yes,
give this young woman a call. She has already been a champion in your equipment.
Nürburgring class winner in their equipment.
Yes. Yeah, just this year, as a matter of fact. Bietzka Visser, she's still only in her early 20s. She was racing against the likes of Sainz and Gasly, and yes... I know she didn't really succeed in Formula 3.5 until after Renault and Red Bull had pulled the plug. I get that, but with her BMW ties, I feel like they've got to give her a seat in DTM at some point, at the absolute minimum.
Yeah, and even though, you know, we saw her face very often at the BMW Andretti garages, and it seems like they're probably going to sign Maxi Günther next year, maybe, you know, stick around. You know, formally a bit longer.
I get
maybe an opportunity to come up.
I would hope so, because it would be, because the thing that critics of the W Series have pointed out is that, you know, to them it feels like the W Series is a set destination rather than a stepping stone, and I would hate for this to be the be all and end all for some drivers who clearly have aspirations and talent beyond just this developmental championship. I would hope I'm wrong, but I would love to see Chadwick and Visser get meaningful opportunities at top-tier drives, being Formula One, WEC, Formula E, you name it, they're worth it. And Alice Powell, my goodness, she should not be a full-time plumber.
Yeah, she's way too fast to be a plumber.
She's way too good at this.
She's faster than Mario.
Good
gracious. Whoa.
Of kart fame. Wait, that was of Mario Kart fame.
I would say this. If there is ever a point where Pippa Man can no longer run the Indianapolis 500, get Alice Powell in that ride.
Please.
Yeah. All in all, I was really pleasantly surprised by the W Series. And, you know, it seems like from reports... from people like F1's own Will Buxton that were there. They created a really good atmosphere, and young girls were just, like, all enamored with their favorite drivers, which, that's what you want.
Yep. That's kind of the point of this whole exercise.
That's really, really, really freaking cool. And hopefully much better things will come for the years to come in 2020 and beyond. Marco Wittmann and Rene Rast won the DTM races, by the way. And Rene Rast now has an even larger points lead.
Because Rene Rast is Rene Fast.
Yes, noted Project Cars 2 salesman, Rene Rast.
Rene, I want my money back.
So, also, it's interesting to note that, let's say someone were to go to International Formula 3 next year, in theory, based on this year's schedules... They could do both.
That would be really, really, really cool. Because I believe there are some drivers who are doing International F3 and Euro Formula Open and one of the regional champions at the same time. Like, I know both of Honda's juniors in F3 are doing that.
Yeah, just accruing as much seat time as possible.
You don't get to stack up super license point, but you do get to stack up seat time, and that's what's really important, because that's what helped Lando Norris and Max Verstappen be ready so damn quickly.
Yes.
Oh, man. What's on the agenda for the weekend ahead? We got IndyCar coming up at Pocono.
I'll be there.
You will be there. Friends of the show will be there. Former guests and co-hosts will be there. Please, please let them get home safely. And let the race be good, too. But mostly, let's just hope they get home safely.
Yeah.
What else we got going on this weekend? I won't be here for next week's show. Because I'll be traveling. I'm very scared about trans-Pacific flights.
It's like, oh dear. It's like, hopefully Dre will be back next week, so it won't just be me.
We got Super Formula this weekend.
Yes.
At yes. Twin Ring Motegi.
Extra, yes.
British Touring Cars, German Formula 4, ADAC GT Masters, NASCAR Bristol, baby.
NASCAR at Bristol. Should be a good one.
I remember when that used to be a draw.
The race itself will probably be good. The stands will probably be empty.
What are you talking about? They're going to have a NASCAR YouTubers panel at the event, apparently.
Define NASCAR YouTuber.
That should be fun. And we won't at all talk about the, shall we say, the sponsorship deal that the event has. That's still a thing. King, if we missed any important news updates since the time we started recording?
Let's see. The Monolith has posted a brief interview with Alex Albon while he admits that his promotion to Red Bull feels surreal.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Tying a bow on everything again. Pierre Gasly is going down. Alex Albon is going up.
Yep, and also an interview with Zach Brown talking about Alonso's potential involvement with the McLaren IndyCar project. You know it's going to be actual involvement. You know he's going for the Triple Crown. Yeah. And he said that he will be seeing Fernando at the Italian Grand Prix. I suppose we'll see what happens from there.
We'll see. All that, and as we promised, we'll have some sort of F1 half-term report. We don't know how in-depth it's going to be. And boy, developments today have really kind of altered the trajectory of this program. but we'll have that. We'll talk Super Formula. If anything else happens, we'll break that to you. We'll talk IndyCar. And thank you very, very much for listening to this episode. You can, of course, listen to all episodes of Motorsport 101 on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcast. All of our podcasts and written materials are on motorsport101.com. Social media, youtube.com/motorsport101, facebook.com/motorsport101. We're on Twitter at motorsport_101. Our personal handles at Harrison101HD, at Ryan Eric King, at RJ O'Connell, at CBuckley917. Drop the vowels. Drop the vowels is not part of Cam's Twitter handle, by the way. I just need to point that out. If you try searching Ryan Eric King, that's with two K's as a full Twitter handle, you're not going to get much. King, I think you should just squat on that Twitter handle.
I think it's too long to actually be a Twitter handle.
Yeah. Get the rules changed.
Come on, Jack, you coward. And of course, patreon.com/motorsport101, where for just $5 of your hard-earned money, you can get early access to all of the shows on the Motorsport 101 family. And for $10 a month, we will let you into our Discord supporter section to listen to each show as it's recorded. God help me why you would want to do so. Oh, who are we kidding? The Sin Bin is a wonderful place, and we thank everybody for listening. Our audience count includes Charles and Tony. Vincent is here. Happy 6-month anniversary there. Jason, Henry is here. Josette, Vikesh, and Brian are all here and have been with us throughout parts of the show. So thank you so, so much for listening, you bunch of heathens. Oh, man. Before any other crazy shit happens, for Andre Harrison, they've been Ryan King, Cam Buckley. I'm Archie O'Connell. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Motorsport 101. Later, y'all.
Bye.
Till next time.